Today's reading is taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and can be found on page 1154 of the Church Bibles. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all the mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. And where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, and I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection, as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you very much, Jenny. We've all heard that reading a number of times, and I think there are two really noteworthy times that it's been read where I thought, gosh, it's been read well. Once was just then, Jenny Perry. The other was Tony Blair. Do you remember Tony Blair? At Princess Diana's memorial service. And it was read so movingly. Thank you. We never know, as it has been written, we never know what is around the corner. And that is what I want to talk to you about today. And I'm conscious that one or two people sitting here now have heard me and heard my story once or twice before. Or if you're my sister, 32 times. And it's not a new story, so I'm sorry, but it's the same old story. And I hope that something I can share with you will be of value to you this afternoon. Choices, folks. I don't know how many choices we make a day. We just Googled it, and we found out that we make something like 35,000 choices in a day. Some might be a little bit more important than others, but anyway, a choice and making wise choices is a huge part of what it means to live, I think, a functional and effective life. When we go back, or when I go back, 4 or 5 years, back to the London Olympics in 2012, life couldn't have been, as William was touched on earlier, couldn't have been better. I was married, I am married. We have 4 children, and I had been a teacher for 16 years. I've been a housemaster in a boarding school for 9 of those years, and at that time I was beginning to get slightly itchy feet and think, right, it's now time to perhaps go and do something else. So I applied for a headship, the headship of a prep school, and it was actually the prep school where my 4 children were. And a surprise to myself, and a surprise I think to many people, I managed to get that job. And so walking tall with a sort of, wow, haven't I done jolly well? I'm 39, I'm going to be a headmaster. life is really couldn't have been better. We're going to be moving into a house with beautiful views out over the Midford Valley. We were close to Bath, so my wife was happy with the shopping. We had a sort of golf course in the front garden, so I was sort of planning on how I could make that into an Augusta. I think it would have been quite a job. But our children's education was set fair, and put simply, life couldn't have been at that moment much better. And so having got the job, there was one final condition that I needed to fulfil, and that was to go for something called a medical. Now, I'm not sure whether many of you have been for a medical, but it made me feel a bit like a sort of football kind of player. Luis Suarez or Lionel Messi, subject to a medical. So I bounced off, if I'm honest with you, full of intrigue to the local doctor, the school doctor, Dr. Goff. And Dr. Goff, very kind man, said lots of sort of prodding and jumping up and down and, this and that, and finished up with the old eye test, which I'm sure a few of you have had before. And the acuity board came out at the end, and my left eye was covered over, and I went racing down it. Bring it on. Absolutely nailed that. Right eye covered over, and I couldn't even see the big, fat, bold A at the top. To the point that actually my doctor looked at me and said, James, are you teasing me? And I said, I'm not, no. He said, well, you basically can't see with your left eye. And I said, no. He said, did you not know? And I said, well, I sort of thought, well, I'm getting a little bit older and, these things happen. And he said, James, I'm sure there's not a problem, he said to me, but I am going to have to refer you on to the opticians. So the following day, I went to the opticians. And I actually look at that like it's a miracle, because I'm usually a real mañana man. And I would have sort of thought, well, next year I might get round to going to the optician. But I think the fact that I'd just been appointed to become a headmaster, I thought, well, I must do these things properly now. So off I went to the optician. And she observed exactly the same thing. There were torches to the back of the eyes, the same old tests, and, crash, failed every one. And so she said, James, I can't see a problem, but I am going to have to refer you on. I'm going to have to refer you to the ophthalmic department, which is the sort of eye specialist at the RUH, the big hospital in Bath. And that's where I went the following morning. And I remember so vividly, folks, it was a Friday morning. And on the Saturday, we were due to be going on holiday to Greece with our four children, who, excuse my French, were wetting themselves with excitement. So there were sort of armbands and there were everything going on. And I still feel slightly indebted to this neighbour, because I think my wife and I, beautiful morning, we said, we'll be about an hour or so. If you could just keep a bit of an eye on the children, that would be great. It wasn't an hour. It was 9.5 hours later that we returned. And we returned with the news that Daddy had a brain tumour. And that was, there were two really haunting things that I remember so vividly about that day. The first was having had one or two MRI scans. I'd had two, actually. And I was sitting with my wife at the end of this little corridor. And, we were sort of chatting kind of the trivialities of what time should we leave tomorrow? Where are we going to get breakfast? What about a coffee? All that sort of stuff. And the door opens. And along comes an Italian registrar. Probably not the NHS way. She came and she gave me an enormous hug. And you could see that actually she had been in tears. And she said to me, you are a very poorly man. She said, we're currently deciding on whether to airlift you out of Bath to Bristol tonight. And that was the moment at which I had the presence of mind to say, what's actually wrong with me? I didn't know, I was going to be airlifted. And I thought, could you tell me, please, why? What's happening? And then we got home. And, sure enough, the children were sort of climbing up the walls. And, so excited. And this bit still really, really moves me as I share it. I remember the four of them, we sat down on a sofa. And we sat them down and we said, we're not going to be able to go to Greece. That's Mum and Dad. And, I remember my son looking at me. He was then about 11, and he said, Dad, why? What's happened? Are you okay? And I said, I've got a brain tumour. And he then looked at me and he said, are you going to die? Wow, that was a fastball. And I then said, I am going to fight it with all I've got, bud. And do you know what, folks? A fight it has been. And a fight it is. You know, fight it is. I then had to go into surgery where I had 27 hours of open brain surgery. You know, the old sort of chop your head open and your brain flops out on a bench and they sort of hoover it off and I don't know what they do with it. I spent 80 days in hospital, during which I couldn't talk, and I didn't love talking, and I couldn't eat. I also quite like eating. I couldn't drink either. I mustn't say I don't like drinking, but anyway, I couldn't do any of that. And then I came out of hospital, and at that time, when I came out, I couldn't walk, I couldn't talk, and I was really depleted. I was really dilapidated. And actually, the biggest issue that I've had has been, as a result of the second surgery, is losing the majority of my sight. So actually, as I stand here with my sort of notes, I might as well throw them over my shoulder, really. And thankfully, William can come up here and do us a dance if all else goes wrong. So that was a challenge, and you know, coming out and being in this really, really depleted sort of half body state. And that has been actually the sort of, I suppose, the journey of the last 4 or 5 years is like this gathering strength and, you know, just trying to kind of, you know, I suppose, claim life back. And it has not always been easy. I have many challenges, one which I was asked to share, actually, by somebody who's heard me speak before. I have many of these sort of embarrassing moments. And one of them happened on a train about a month ago, where I sat on a man's sandwich. And he was absolutely furious with me. And he shouted for the whole carriage, saying, "You effing blind!" At which point I held out my little white cane and I said, "Yes, I am." "Oh, yeah, I feel so stupid now," he said. At which point the whole carriage were just in gales, absolute gales. I also had an incident where I was walking along a beach. And I find beaches really challenging because, of course, they're all the same colour. So I can never see up, down, you know, where things are. And I was walking along with my daughter, quite a self-conscious sort of 12-year-old. So she was pulling me along like a slightly disobedient dog. And we got to this picnic. And there was this picnic beautifully laid out. And my daughter saw the picnic in front of us. She then let go of my hand and walked round to the right, assuming that I was going to walk round to the left. No, I went straight on, straight through the middle of this picnic. It's almost like a scene from Monty Python, isn't it? It's like, what is this guy doing? Anyway, I got to the other side and my dear daughter gave me the most enormous telling off and made me actually go back. She was playing sort of adult, made me go back and apologise for what I'd just done. So I have these embarrassing moments. I have lots of sort of moments where it's sort of coming to terms with the reality of, you know, can't see. Lots of things I can't do. And I remember I used to have a tradition with the boys in my house, where at the end of the year, at the end of their time at school, actually as sort of 18-year-olds, they were going to come out of school, and I would go for a beer. I was going to say a final beer. Sounds like we were sort of drinking beer the whole time, which we weren't. And we would sit down, and the first beer I had was with this guy called Ben, amazing boy, Ben Watson, who was actually head boy, and in his gap year cycled from Cairo to Cape Town, so he was quite something of a human being. And I got down to the pub. It was about a four-minute walk, and it took me, at that time, about 40 minutes. Really slow progress. Down I went, you know, and I got there. And he said, "Sir, I don't really want any of your questions." I thought, "Oh, Ben, it's taken me half a day, and, you know, literally it's going to take me months to recover." And he said, "Sir, I just want to know how you have got through this year." And actually, it's quite interesting because it's actually a mantra that I now, 5 years on, still really hold and live my life by. And I wonder whether it might be of use to you all on your journeys. I said to Ben, the first and most important thing, and there's a sense of irony that I'm going to talk to you about looking. And really, as a blind man, you know, actually, you know, looking isn't something I can do a huge amount of. But I said to Ben, the first and I think most important thing is that we look up. Looking up is so important. Looking up. I remember being in the ward, the high dependency unit at the French Air Hospital, and sometimes screens would come and be put around people's beds, and that meant that those people had died as they were gently wheeled out of the ward. Bye-bye. So there I was at the age of 40, really right on the edge of this mortal coil, right on the edge. You know, and having sort of dreamt the dreams and living the life, and life couldn't be better, suddenly I was thrown into this place. And it wasn't really a question of God why, it was a question of God how. How do I get through this? And I'm not sure whether why is ever really a pertinent question. I don't think this side we're ever really going to know why a suffering event happens. But what I think I can stand up here for, so stand up here now, and I can vouch to the fact that we serve a real God who is with us. As I just said, God, how? In the depths of pain and darkness, that verse in Psalm 121, I lift my eyes to the hills, where does my help come from? Well, it comes from God, the maker of heaven and earth. And I can really vouch to his goodness, to his greatness, to his there-ness. I remember my wife stuck a little postcard to the end of my bed, and it was that verse from Deuteronomy, you know, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And at times, wow, did I hold on to that, you know, as I felt utterly forsaken. I remember those mornings when you get a sort of bed bath and you were honestly treated like you were a pub floor. You know, so that somebody comes along and pushes you around, it's like, ah! You know, and you really had to just remember that you've not been forgotten or forsaken. The second thing that I said to Ben is the importance of looking forward. I think it's easy often to look back. To look back, what made Britain great? You know, why are we great? The good old days when I could drive a car, hit a golf ball, when I was perhaps going to be a headmaster, all those things, that's the past. That old adage of don't cry over spilt milk. Well, I think that's so true. I sometimes imagine my life being a little bit like a train whistling along a valley floor. And yep, it met a series of boulders. And yep, it crashed into those boulders. And the temptation, I think, as humankind is always to try and clamber back onto that same old train. Keep on plodding on. Life's no different. It's absolutely the same. But actually now my track is going off in a different direction. I'm not entirely sure where it's going. But the key thing is that we keep looking forward. Because that's where the hopes, the opportunities, the possibilities are. They're in front of us. They're not beside us. Or behind us, sorry. We must keep looking forward, is what I said to Ben. The third thing that I said to Ben is that we keep looking out. Keep looking out. I think that the final book that I read before losing my sight was that fabulous sort of masterpiece written by Viktor Frankl, the Austrian Jew who survived at Auschwitz. And he talked about Auschwitz, which made actually the French Air Hospital seem rather lovely. And he then talked about how he managed to survive in a place where literally thousands, if not even a million, Jews were gassed to death, thousands a day. And he talks about how every 2 weeks or so they were given a bread bun. And this was a starving man, folks. Now, if you were starving, the temptation would be, oh, look over there, I'll nick yours, and you know, and it was always, you know, bread bun day, you would absolutely make a feast of them, wouldn't you? But he did the opposite. And he would you know, on that bread ban day, he would tear up his bread ban and he would share it and give it to people that he thought looked more in need than him. And as he did that, so the happy hormones or the endorphins or the, I'm not sure what they're called, were released that made him feel more fully alive and more complete. And folks, that I think is so true. And on those days where I wake up and I think, oh, joke's over, I want to see. And I've also had two small strokes, so my balance is really shot, and I walk into the door frame and wheel over the floor, and it's, oh, gosh, after about 2 minutes of the day, you're 3-0 down, and you're thinking, oh, I give up. But actually, that's the point at which the UFO, Lord, I need you. Keep looking forward. There's hope today. There's a pointer today. Look out. What can I do for someone else? How are you? Send somebody an encouraging text. Buy your children a lollipop and put it under their pillow, or do something for someone else. It may be as small as just a how are you, or empty the dishwasher, or get somebody the milk under the fridge. I don't know what, but that look out. And at the end of talking to Ben, Ben very matter-of-factly said, sir, I think you've got a talk there. I said, oh, God, Ben. He said, why is that? He said, well, the way I see it is if a UFO should hit your life, you respond with a UFO, looking up, looking forward, looking out. I said, oh, thanks, Ben. So there it is, folks. We must look up. We must look forward, which is hope. I love that verse in Hebrews 6, verse 19, where it talks about hope being an anchor to our souls. It holds us down in those times, those storms, those times of difficulty. And looking out, I think in Philippians 3, it talks about considering other people more important than ourselves. The opposite to up, forward and out, is to look down, is to look back, and is to look in. And I would breed that to be a dangerously bleak individual. We don't want to be that. We want to, as Christian people, always recognise that we have hope, that we have purpose, that we have meaning, and we do. And I think it ultimately is a choice. Back to the 35,000 choices we have a day. Often we've got to make that choice. Yeah, no, I'm a believer. No, my life's got hope. No, my life's got meaning. I'm not going to give up now. It's certainly not as bad as Viktor Frankl's. Certainly not as bad as I was in Johannesburg last week. Sounds rather flash, that, doesn't it? But wow, you know, you look at some of those people. I spoke to a big group of young people who were in wheelchairs. And you looked at those people and you thought, oh my word, what a tough challenge you guys have got. Just to conclude, I sometimes go for a walk now. We've got a dog. And me taking a dog for a walk is a slightly sort of hazardous process, but occasionally it does happen. And off I go, and I fill my pockets full of sort of, you know, dog treats. And off we march, Alfie and I. And Alfie and I were walking along. It was a year or two ago now, actually, if I'm honest with you. And I walked straight round a corner into a horse. I don't know whether any of you have ever done that, but I walked straight into this horse, collision, head first. And I was slightly embarrassed, if I'm honest with you, but I also didn't see it, really. She came round, you know, it was blended in with the bush and straight into the horse. And I sort of picked myself up and I was dusting myself down, and at which point she said, you know, are you okay? And I said, I'm absolutely fine. Is the horse okay? I said, oh, please, don't worry about the horse, she said. She said, did you not see us coming? And I said, if I'm honest with you, no, I didn't see. She said, oh, are you blind? And I said, pretty much so, yeah. She then said, so have you always been blind? I said, no, I you know, just really, you know, the last few years since I had this brain tumour. She then said, gosh, so how do you get through? It must be absolutely awful at times. And I shared with her exactly what I've just shared with you now, that it's all about looking up, looking forward and looking out. That is my absolute mantra. And she looked at me quite quizzically. She said, Doesn't it say something in the Bible about that? And that is, of course, what Jenny has just read to us, that these three remain: faith, hope, and love. That's up, forward, and out. And I think what I can do, folks, is that I can stand, I can put my hand, I can put both hands, I can jump up and down, and I can say that if the UFO hits your life, that if something inexplicable, something awful, something really challenging, that actually taking that route of faith, hope, and love, that it really does provide us with a purpose and a reason to get out of bed in the morning and not to give up. Thanks for listening to me, guys.